You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. Efa Akene coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about Budget 2025, particularly its impact on rangatahi and the Regulatory Standards Bill. For International Desk, I spoke to Greenpeace campaigner Jerissa Lee about the upcoming United Nations Ocean Conference. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson on Auckland Council's recent approval for the new development in the city centre, as well as the latest updates in the Western Springs Speedway versus Stadium debate. For my second topic of national and global military spending, I spoke with both Massey University Defence and Security Associate Professor Anna Powers and Peace Movement Aotearoa Coordinator Edwina Hughes.
Heha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 3093879. Ka awa e wari wari I ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō, e pākehere roki roki mārunga I te pai, tuku tuku o I rangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM I re kati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Lima Toru Iwarima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Last Thursday, Budget 2025, the Growth Budget, was announced. As part of the budget, there were significant changes to KiwiSaver, including an increase to the default employee and employer contribution rates and a decrease in government contributions. The Council of Trade Unions has expressed concern about the KiwiSaver changes, stating they could impact low-income workers the most as they lose potential savings in compound interest. However, they have praised the extension of the KiwiSaver scheme to 16 and 17-year-olds. There are also new eligibility limits for 18 and 19-year-olds to access benefits based on parental income. Youth advocates have expressed concern for young people who cannot get support from their families due to a relationship breakdown or the high cost of living. And the ACT Party's Regulatory Standards Bill has passed its first reading and is now before the Finance and Expenditure Committee. Leader David Seymour has described the bill as being about transparent and sensible regulation. However, the bill has been criticised for its potential effect on the place of Te Tiriti o Waitangi in our laws. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about both of these issues. Here is that interview. Who benefits from Budget 2025?
Well, that's hard to say. Probably big business and the mates of the National Party. I've been really concerned about this budget that National has cut women's pay and people's retirement savings.
Do you think the changes to KiwiSaver were reasonable?
Well, I'm not sure that anything that this government has done has been reasonable. National has taken money out of women's future pay packets and raided our kids' retirement savings to subsidise what we've seen fossil fuel industries. So, you know, this government hasn't been realistic in the budget that they've allocated this time round. we're concerned about that and we've been pretty vocal about it.
Is there a risk that people, particularly in the public sector, could be paid less in take-home pay to compensate for the increased KiwiSaver employer contributions?
Well, certainly Kiwis have been asked to contribute more, and employers, you know, will have to contribute more as well. The part that I'm most concerned about is that if we think about, you know, my nephew, for example, 18 years old, if they start out KiwiSaver today, they'll lose $66,000 from this government and the decision that they've made. That's just not good enough. We're really proud of KiwiSaver. We think it's a great scheme. And we want government to be able to do their part.
Is it appropriate to means test the parents of 18 and 19-year-olds before they can receive job seeker or emergency benefits?
Well, every young person has different circumstances. And so, you know, means testing means that that the government may not understand fully the circumstances of that of those young people. I think of a number of rainbow young people who have left home for different reasons. They're not supported by their parents. And, you know, that this creates great concern around how are their needs going to be met under this new regime.
As called for by advocacy groups, should there be targeted support in the budget for young people who are unemployed or homeless?
Certainly. You know, we saw $1 billion come out of the emergency housing budget, and you know, I think of organisations like Kickback and AJ Hendry's comments. You know, have really highlighted the homelessness issue for young people here in Tāmaki Makaurau. We have raised that a number of times in the House and called for a response from this government. They don't tend to acknowledge that there is a problem. You know, and so that's the arrogance of this government that we're seeing.
In general, was this a budget that should inspire hope in young people? Why or why not?
Well, young people and women are paying for this budget, and so there's no hope there, sadly. The announcements that the government have made, you know, have been negative ones towards supporting young people. When we went into the House under urgency post-budget for 3 days, you know, two of those bills were about taking away support for young people. That's not good enough. That makes me really sad.
Why is Labor against the Regulatory Standards Bill?
Well, the Regulatory Standards Bill puts a framework in place that takes away the protections of both Te Tiriti, but also the protections of our environment, of our well-being, of all the things that we love as New Zealanders. I've been calling it Treaty Principles Bill 2.0. That's because the same principles that were put forward in the Treaty Principles Bill are also featured heavily in the Regulatory Standards Bill. It pushes power back to David Seymour. It's a far-right attempt to take that power. And it really shows once again that Prime Minister Luxon isn't in control.
Could this bill reignite some of the debate that emerged from the Treaty Principles Bill?
It already has. You'll see across social media there's been a number of calls for people to make their submissions, and I really encourage people to do that as well. We can't take another risk here, and so turnout of submissions is really important. But this isn't just a Māori issue. The Regulatory Standards Bill affects every New Zealander, and particularly those more vulnerable, so Māori, Pacific, people with disabilities, our rainbow community, you know, so I'm calling for all of those people to make submissions. This bill cannot proceed.
Why do you think the bill is gaining traction now when it has failed in the past?
Well, it depends on which way you're looking at it. You know, it's gaining traction in terms of the number of people against it. It's gaining traction to highlight how weak our Prime Minister is in leading this country. So, you know, the traction is yet to be determined. The traction comes about because of the ACT Party being in government, that this is their attempt to put a far-right agenda back in place that will remove protections from, you know, from New Zealanders. And so, you know, that's why I'm encouraging people to make a submission via the Select Committee, and hopefully it will be another embarrassment to the ACT Party and the government, just like the Treaty Principles Bill was.
Is it appropriate for the government to use urgency to move through controversial bills, particularly in the shadow of the budget?
In this case, it was unnecessary. From time to time, governments will use urgency. The government put up 11 bills under urgency last week, post-budget. Only two of those bills were relevant to the budget. The regulatory standards bill didn't need to go through at that particular time under urgency, just like the Ministry of Social Development bills that went through taking away the rights of young people in our system. This government has an incredibly high number of bills going through urgency, all three stages. That is incredible, and it's not the democratic system that New Zealanders want to see.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on Budget 2025, particularly its impacts on Rangatahi and the Regulatory Standards Bill.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
After years of discussion, Auckland Council's Planning and Policy Committee have approved zoning changes for the city centre, which will see taller buildings and increased development capacity within the central business district. Plan Change 78 sought to increase density and will see double height limits for most of the city centre, up to 20 stories, unlimited building height for a small section, and the removal of limitations on floor plans to attract investment into a wide variety of building types. With notification of this decision made tomorrow, the changes are expected to be included in the Auckland Unitary Plan to become operative in June this year. As well, consultation is currently open in relation to the Western Springs Speedway, of which Auckland Council voted in favour of eviction last year based on financial underperformance. The decision to keep the speedway, develop a new stadium, or explore new opportunities for the space has been a hot topic in public debate, with figures like former All Blacks Sir Brian Williams, Rich Lister Anna Mowbray, and her husband, former All Black Ali Williams, chiming into the discussion. I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson this week about both of these topics, starting with the future of development in Auckland's central city. Auckland Council has accepted recommendations that will help deliver more homes, more businesses, and better access to the heart of Tamaki Makaurau. What were some of the key drivers behind this decision?
Yeah, look, I think just as you said in the question, we've got to acknowledge that this will move the city centre forward, and it will ultimately be a good thing. It does a lot of good things for the city centre. One of the drivers of the decision is to get more and more people living there, and that is extra consumers, that is also vibrancy for events and activities. There's a safety element to all that. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the more people we have living in the city centre, the better. I think that makes it a great place to live. The changes have brought that a little bit closer, but, you know, as I voted at the time, I don't think it went far enough personally.
Auckland Council has approved a zoning change for the city centre to allow unlimited building heights for a small section of the CBD and double height limits for the rest of the city centre. However, in an interview with RNZ, Coalition for More Homes spokesperson Scott Caldwell said limiting most of the city centre to 20 stories is too restrictive. How would you respond to this comment?
Yeah, Scott is 100% correct in this, in my view. And look, I don't see the sense in having an unlimited height on such a small area, because when you look at what they're doing all over the world, places like Vancouver, Copenhagen, they're allowing you know, higher buildings and train-linked neighbourhoods as of right, and that's normal. In our situation, we're still saying, you know, you can build next to places like brand new CRL stations, not very far from walking, and would have to downzone in some of these places because there's restricted heights. I don't understand why that is the case. If a developer can make it work, surely we should just build up and take advantage of the CRL.
This intensification plan, Change 78, has been in deliberation and consultation for several years now. Why has this proposal taken so long to actualise?
Well, there's probably a couple of reasons, but I think one of the main reasons is that politics plays a major factor. But also, look, there's a lot of detail that's involved and a lot of people have worked very hard to get these things across the line. There's some real human hours of work behind all of this that takes so long to do. But going back to kind of the political element of this as well, is that there's plenty of politicians out there that would try and downzone things as much as they could and to restrict homes basically everywhere. And this is an attitude that I think we should be fighting against as a city. And that is kind of why I voted the way I did in the debate, is that, look, the city centre changes, for example, they do good things, but they're not far enough. I think that we should be looking at more housing, where it makes sense along train lines and rapid transit stations. And that's a better planned city. That means less sprawl into the outer suburbs and food-growing land being built on. These things we don't have to deal with when we're actually zoning things properly and allowing building. So things take a long time because that is a complicated and political discussion that, you know, nearly everyone in Auckland will have an opinion on.
Do you have any concerns about how this plan of intensification will drive up construction or noise pollution in the city, or make the city more congested, or even inhibit aspirations to pedestrianise Queen Street?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I have no concerns at all about that. In fact, look, the way to tackle congestion is to allow more homes where people are studying, where people are working, where there are rapid transit nodes to get to where people want to go. And so that actually combats congestion. And it also supports the public transport network that we have and promotes that. That means better air quality. That means lower transport emissions, which affects climate change. So, you know, I think this kind of move, I would say that we're not going far enough rather than too far. I think these are fantastic moves. We need to be doing more of them.
Moving on to my next topic, this is something I've spoken about on City Councilling before, but the Western Springs Speedway versus Stadium thing seems to be quite ongoing. Why do you think this decision has caused such heated debate among the public?
Yeah, any time you talk about a stadium in Auckland, there is huge, huge feelings and huge debate about it. It seems to sort of touch Aucklanders. And, you know, every Aucklander has opinions about their stadiums and they can be quite firmly held, shall we say. And, you know, Western Springs in particular, it's been used as a speedway track for, you know, nearly 100 years. And so there's some real nostalgia there for people. People have grown up watching cars on that track. So, you know, I can understand the depth of feeling. I really can. And so that's why this continues to bubble up and continues to be a big debating point.
In favour of the redevelopment of the space at Western Springs, Mayor Wayne Brown argues that the current speedway is a fiscal burden for taxpayers, saying that the council's proposal to relocate the speedway to Waikaraka Park would give it a much brighter future. You've talked a bit about the nostalgia of the space maybe, but why do you think this idea hasn't been accepted by stakeholders hoping to keep the speedway in Western Springs?
Well, it's kind of a debate that I don't, you know, it wouldn't be really appropriate for me to kind of wade into it too much because we're in the middle of a public consultation period and I'm focusing on listening rather than talking about the situation. So look, I just do want to plug to people that on the AK Have Your Say website, you can jump in and you can obviously have your say until the 15th of June around how you see the future of Western Springs Stadium. There's some proposals on the table, which is just briefly Auckland Arena, which is a bespoke 12 to 15K stadium with, you know, for football and for other sports and things like that primarily. Or the Western Springs Bowl proposal, which combines music, festival venue and kind of rugby club situation, or none of the above. That's an option there as well. So, you know, I just would use that opportunity to plug that. And so jump on AK Have Your Say and you share how you feel about that and then we'll keep the conversation going.
Yes, thanks for sharing that. With the proposal to develop a Western Springs stadium, is that at all in coordination with the plans to redevelop Eden Park as Auckland's main stadium?
Oh, they're actually completely different processes. So they're completely different bespoke processes. So the Eden Park stuff, I'm all over, right? I've been doing that for a couple of years in terms of chairing that working group to come up with the options and then narrow them down. We landed that, and I'm actually kind of really proud of that, that we've been really clear as a city that the National Stadium, we have the option in front of us, and it's up to Eden Park to get the money together and start building. That's kind of our message there. So it's a completely different process to Western Springs, but at the same time, look, stadiums are things we've had to sort out for decades as a city. I'm actually quite glad that we're having these conversations, even though they're tough. We need to provide people with certainty.
Do you think that any of the proposals do well to balance the needs and wants of both the community and the importance of the space while also being economically justifiable? Or is there kind of, when it comes down to it, a need to prioritise either financial viability or community perspectives in this decision?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, look, we've had presentations from both of the bidders in the Western Springs Stadium area. And, look, I think they are both fantastic and really good options. But that's up to the public to tell us what they think is viable and what they think actually is a good option. But what I will say is that question around financial viability, to me as a decision maker, that's a huge, huge factor. So things have to wash their face. They have to make sense financially for the ratepayer. That is sort of my number one consideration. And then from there, let's let the public decide. It'll be a really interesting process.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on the intensification of Auckland CBD and the Western Springs saga.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B. This is Sam Marlon Williams.
Manu e kakapa i roto rā mehe manu koe hoki rere atu ki wawa mawa i e kiki te tātaki o te rau he taonga te ware ware ka maumahara ke au hai hai a te marama Maringi toto miraka, tirama rama atu, e kimi ake rā.
Ka hore te taumaha e pehanga no rungara. O maake tonu ai, ka peke a ngā matata. E kore ki te anau, e te hoa hotoke. He pohewa tonu ai, i te makaro e.
Hai hai a te marama, maringi toto miraka. Tirama rama atu, e kimi ake rā. Ka hore I tai aha, te tuku mihi koropai. He koingo,
he karanga,
kia ripeka haramai.
Spend an afternoon being invigorated by creativity, community and kai. At Reo Taiohe Mai, the Glen Eden Playhouse Theatre, Sunday, June 1st.
A totally free event exploring youth perspectives on democracy through art and community connection. With music from Samara Alofa and Polly Hill.
And improv theatre by Courtney Eggleton, Renton Oneroa, Melissa Matter and Lucy Dauber.
Reo Taiohe Mai, Sunday, June 1st at 1:30 p.m. With thanks to Buzzly.
Of course, it is within this...
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed.
Shut up.
Of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95 BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost. The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. right here on 95BFM.
Oh, anake ki te waka ki te moana. Kaore kau e matangi, kaore he ahane. Titiro mai, titiro mai. Te ama katau ke atu nei hau atura ka mate au ki te moana marie ka
National Desk are go.
From 9th June, the United Nations Ocean Conference is being held in France, which is co-hosting the event with Costa Rica. The theme for the conference is accelerating action and mobilizing all actors to conserve and sustainably use the ocean. More than 50 world leaders are expected to attend, with 1,500 delegates from almost 200 countries. France has stated it hopes the conference will mark a turning point in the protection of global oceans. The conference follows the world's first deep-sea mining application for the International Seabed, which was submitted to the United States government as opposed to the United Nations regulator. In the Pacific, both the Cook Islands and New Zealand are exploring the possibility of seabed mining, although little is known about the potential environmental impact. I spoke to Jurisa Lee, Te Rarawa, Ngāpuhi, Rarotonga, seabed mining campaigner at Greenpeace, about the conference. I started by asking if they could outline what the conference actually is and who will be there.
This is the third conference of its kind. So the United Nations Oceans Conference was kind of established to support what they call SDG 14, which says conserve and sustainably use the ocean, seas and marine resources for sustainable development. It will be in Nice in France, and it will be co-hosted by France and Costa Rica. And we expect high-level attendance from member states, including heads of states and ministers in attendance, but also like Greenpeace, and there'll be a strong civil society presence, indigenous groups and representatives of other priority sectors, priority communities in attendance as well.
Could we see global partnerships to protect our oceans emerge from this, particularly in the protection of international waters?
Yes, so unlike climate COPs or, you know, the biodiversity COPs, there won't be any negotiations at UNOC, but it is an opportunity for member states to do a few things around ocean protection. So what we'd really like to see is, you know, at the moment with regards to deep sea mining, we'd like to see that so far we have 33 member states who are calling for a global moratorium on deep sea mining, and we would like to see that number increase. We also know that, you know, the BBNJ, that the Oceans Treaty, we'd like to see the number of countries that ratifying that increases as well. And Greenpeace will also be using UNOC as an opportunity to engage with member states just ahead of the final negotiating meeting in August on the Global Plastics Treaty. So our hopes are that member states and you know, especially with high-level attendance, participation, that we can get some strong calls for ocean protection.
In recent years, there's been increasing discussion of seabed mining in the Pacific, particularly in the Cook Islands. Could this conference have an impact on these plans?
I would hope so. You know, we've also just seen, just earlier in the year, we've seen the deep sea mining industry and align themselves with the new United States administration seeking to mine the, you know, in international waters, so outside national jurisdiction, which is circumventing the UN processes, you know, that would happen at the International Seabed Authority and would be a breach of international rules. And so UNOC is another opportunity for these member states to stand strong against this insult to multilateralism and to the global community and global cooperation. And they can do that by really affirming a strong support for a moratorium on deep sea mining. And I think if we were to see that kind of galvanized stand and that influenced the Pacific region, I think it could have an influence over what governments such as the Cook Islands and how they move forward.
In the past, environmental protection has been used as a tool of colonisation. I'm thinking of the Chagos Islands in particular. Will Indigenous advocates be heard at this conference?
I'm aware of colleagues, Indigenous colleagues, including Pacific Indigenous colleagues, who will be attending UNOC and working very hard to share their lived experiences, the histories of their island nations, and their Indigenous communities with member states, so that member states are well informed and have these diverse perspectives in anything that they talk about and anywhere that they are present at UNOC.
David Attenborough's recent documentary, Ocean, speaks to conference attendees directly. Will a key environmentalist figure like Attenborough be able to have an impact?
I think that decision makers and world leaders and world governments would benefit greatly from welcoming the expertise and the experiences of all sorts of people who work in and around the ocean, who depend on the ocean, whose cultures are centred around the ocean, and whose livelihoods rely on the ocean and a healthy ocean at that. So yes, key influences, researchers, scientists of many manners, Indigenous communities, coastal communities, they're all the expertise that should be centred in any decisions that we make around the ocean and its sustainability and its protection.
Overall, are you feeling optimistic about the conference?
I would never lose hope. It is, you know, an opportunity to see many people who, to see and meet and speak with many people who care very deeply about the ocean, and also an opportunity to speak to many people who would be responsible for decisions around the protection, stewardship, and the health of the ocean and all the life that it supports on Earth.
What can people who want to see strong outcomes from the conference do to support?
I think I would ask people to be very aware of the threat, this emerging threat of deep sea mining in the Pacific and seabed mining here in Aotearoa. So Trans-Tasman Resources is an Australian mining company. They've been trying for well over a decade to mine the seabed in the South Taranaki Bight, which is home to a very rare species of pygmy blue whales. We've got Maui and Hector dolphins there, Kororā going there to feed. They've been rejected at every turn, including at the Supreme Court. But because of the fast track, there's a real danger that they would get to get the green light, even though they've never been able to prove that they wouldn't cause material harm, significant harm, to the marine life in Taranaki. And this could be the first large-scale commercial seabed mine in the world, and that would set a very dangerous precedent, a very low bar, for deep sea miners everywhere else in the Pacific and globally. And so we must ensure that we stop this new emerging industry from keep them out of our waters and stop this industry before it gets a chance to start.
That was Jerissa Lee, deep sea mining campaigner for Greenpeace, on the upcoming United Nations Ocean Conference.
International Desk on 95BFM.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. This is I Still Love the Moon from Lee.
But I still love the moon, and she loves me too.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Global military expenditure reached a record high of $2.7 trillion in 2024, according to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. This is the 10th consecutive year that military spending has increased across the world. Last week's budget announcement, as with declarations of investments earlier this year, in which $12 billion was committed to defence over the next 4 years, with an aim to reach 2% of GDP, demonstrate the New Zealand government's interest in keeping up with global standards. Peace movement Aotearoa have called this central government decision deplorable, as the same budget made cuts to crucial social services and has underinvested in urgent issues within sectors like health, climate action, and infrastructure. Today, I spoke with Massey University's Associate Professor in the Centre for Defence and Security Studies, Anna Powles, about why both global and national military spending is increasing despite other crucial areas needing investment. I also spoke with Peace Movement Aotearoa coordinator Edwina Hughes about the effects of this increased militarization, taking priority over efforts to address humanitarian issues. I began my interview with Associate Professor Anna Powles by asking what some of the key drivers of this increased global military spending are.
Well, the key drivers for the increase are, firstly, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and as a consequence of that, we've seen significant increase in defence spending in Europe, but also as a consequence of strategic competition in our own region, in the Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific, as it's commonly called now. And there has been a significant increase in spending by China, Japan, South Korea, Southeast Asian states, and the United States and Australia as well.
How have technological advancements and other contemporary factors impacted military and defence spending requirements in New Zealand and globally?
Well, we've seen in the defence sphere the development of both emerging and critical technology, and this we've seen this, you know, particularly in the context of Ukraine. But in the New Zealand context, there is a focus in the recent defence budget around drone systems and other capabilities as well. And this is, for instance, the New Zealand defence budget includes funding for counter-drone systems, for instance. It's considered one of the 15 priority projects, for example. And so the need to be able to support new capabilities obviously has a price tag attached to it.
Do you think the recent defence capability plan is an appropriate response to global geopolitical tensions?
That's a great question, because the question, of course, is, you know, does it provide New Zealand with the material assets and capabilities in order to be able to respond to the types of tensions that we're seeing internationally? And arguably, yes, it is a positive move forward. It provides a type of blueprint outlining the investment necessary for the military over the next 15 years, and that aligns very much with national strategy as well. And where the Defence Capability Plan tries to, what it seeks to do is really sort of rebuild the New Zealand Defence Force, and to ensure that it is so-called sort of fit for purpose for the types of challenges that we are seeing in the future. The challenge, though, is, of course, is the fact that that is a very costly exercise. It's a multi-generational exercise. And the ability to meet those needs as set out is a significant challenge. Now, the DCP, the Defence Capability Plan, you know, it outlines the type of challenging strategic environment that we have, noting that New Zealand faces its most challenging and dangerous strategic environment for decades, and that is a significant shift from the type of language we would have seen 25 years ago under the former Prime Minister Helen Clark, where she talked about a benign strategic environment that New Zealand New Zealanders live in a benign strategic environment. So we see this in a significant shift over that 25-year period, and the particular focus is on the rise of China in the Indo-Pacific, efforts by China to broaden its sphere of influence and the development of its own military capability, which, of course, you know, we saw China's military reach only recently with the live fire exercises by the Chinese PLAN, People's Liberation Navy, in the Tasman Sea very, very recently. So this response to this deteriorating security environment is reflected in the defence capability.
I wanted to ask kind of how you think that this choice to increase military spending and this general global militarization will have adverse impacts on global efforts to collaborate on urgent issues like climate change.
Well, again, you know, that's a great question, because for a long time, climate change was seen as a potential off-ramp for countries who were our peer competitors or strategic competitors to be able to work together, continue to compete, but also work together and cooperate on those existential issues like climate change. Now, it's unclear whether or not that level of cooperation is actually possible or even realistic. And given the level of strategic competition that is escalating. Now, you know, that we're also in a position now where we have an administration in the White House, President Donald Trump, who is fairly disinterested in climate change. And so that is no longer a priority for the United States. And with the United States not part of that conversation, we are missing, you know, one of the critical players in this. And so it's not just militarization which is impacting the ability of countries to cooperate on climate change, but it's also the US administration turning its back on climate change too, which is impacting it.
In your view, how does increased military spending on New Zealand's part impact our relationship with our Pacific neighbours?
Well, this is a very challenging balance for New Zealand to deal with. On the one hand, New Zealand has clear national security priorities, and those include upholding a international rules-based system, including in our own region. And increased military spending is as much about strategic denial, so denying the opportunity of actors whose views, behaviours, etc. do not align with New Zealand, denying them the opportunity to strengthen their military engagement and position and influence in the region. But New Zealand also is well aware that for many Pacific Island countries, and for all Pacific Island countries, there are deep concerns about the militarization of the region. And those deep concerns have very strong historical legacies, particularly, you know, World War II, obviously, but since then, nuclear testing, which has an ongoing legacy in the region, as well as the militarization of the North Pacific, too, so Guam, Palau, and so on, by the United States. So there is this is a very difficult balance for New Zealand to try and achieve. On the one hand, meeting New Zealand's own national security priorities, and on the other hand, balancing its relationships with Pacific Island countries who are opposed to that militarization.
I wanted to get a bit more abstract on my last question. Looking into feminist political theories who would seek to challenge this state-centric model of security that seems to be at the heart of increased global militarization, do you think that advocating these kinds of alternative approaches to addressing global geopolitical tensions would be at all influential in derailing annual increases in defence spending?
I think we need to look at the root causes of the increased defence spending. Would alternative approaches have prevented President Putin from invading Ukraine? Will alternative approaches prevent China under President Xi from pursuing its stated objective of national reunification with Taiwan? So these are very, very challenging and confronting questions to ask ourselves that, unfortunately, realpolitik has very clear examples in both the case of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and China's stated objective of national reunification with Taiwan. And how we respond to those are going to be, and particularly with respect to China, because that's very much in our own region, how we respond to that is going to be one of the critical questions for New Zealand in the next years to come.
My next interview is with Peace Movement Aotearoa coordinator Edwina Hughes to discuss the organisation's concerns about the increased defence budget despite underinvestment in other key issues both globally and nationally. Do you think this defence budget announcement, as well as the government's defence capabilities plan, are an appropriate response to ongoing global geopolitical tensions?
No, we don't think that they're at all an appropriate response. There are many better and more positive things that New Zealand could and should be doing. We have three key concerns about New Zealand's military spending and what it's doing in terms of its seeking to be a combat-capable force multiplier with an enhanced lethality. And so obviously the first one is the comparative cost for us here in Aotearoa in terms of social spending, you know, because every dollar that's spent on the military is a dollar that's taken away from social need here in Aotearoa. And the second key concern would be what it means in terms of support for our Pacific neighbours, who have consistently said that the biggest security issue that they are facing is around climate change and obviously the need for climate justice. And then I think the third key concern that we have is that there are wider questions around New Zealand's military friends, who it's doing military exercises with, and so on and so forth, particularly Israel at this time, which is especially problematic for obvious reasons. And then, and linked to that, is we have key concerns around New Zealand's adherence to its disarmament and other international law commitments.
Yeah, you've alluded to an answer a little bit here, but amidst cuts to public services to eliminate so-called wasteful spending, why do you think the central government has made this decision to prioritise such an increase in the defence budget?
Well, for a start, we don't call it a defence budget because it's clearly not about defending New Zealand. New Zealand doesn't have armed forces that are of a size that could defend this country. New Zealand Armed Forces are deployed overseas in combat, and I mean that's very clear because they're saying that New Zealand is seeking to be a combat-capable force multiplier with enhanced lethality. So that's about New Zealand sending combat forces overseas, and that is not the way that we want to see New Zealand relating to other countries. Consistently over the years, the amount that's been allocated for military spending each year and the amount that's allocated for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So that's all diplomacy, that's climate financing, that's all overseas development assistance, you know, all the funding and so on and so forth. It's always between around a quarter and one third of the amount that's allocated for military spending.
What do you think this increase in military spending reflects about the government's approach to security or intentions in relation to getting involved with global conflict?
I think that it's very clear that it shows that they're stuck in the same old thinking, which is this very narrow, outdated concept of military security, right, which is based on New Zealand being part of the global cycle of violence. But we want to see New Zealand involved in real security, human security, so meeting the needs of people here in Aotearoa and then in the Pacific and then, if circumstances permit, beyond that as well. But we certainly do not want to see New Zealand being a combat-capable force multiplier with enhanced lethality. I mean, what does that say about how New Zealand relates to countries and people in other parts of the world?
What needs to change both globally and nationally for this trend of militarization to be replaced or rerouted towards urgently needed collaborative efforts against the threat of climate change?
Well, this is something where New Zealand could, if it wanted, lead the way. Because New Zealand has such very small armed forces and they are extremely expensive. And at this time when they're talking about getting this, that and the next thing, new frigates, new warships, new planes, you know, blah, 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 what New Zealand needs to be doing is looking at what we actually need in this country, right, which is quite clearly increased social services, health, education and so on and so forth, What do our Pacific neighbours need? They need assistance, particularly around climate justice, obviously, and you just said about the climate emergency. But New Zealand needs to shift from having military forces to send overseas and kill people in other parts of the world to having civilian agencies. So New Zealand, for example, could have, in terms of inshore and offshore capabilities, a civilian coast guard, civilian agencies that help with humanitarian assistance and so on and so forth. And that equipment and the vessels and the aircraft and the vehicles that are needed are much cheaper because they don't need expensive military hardware.
What power do New Zealanders have to protest or reject the decisions that have been made in this budget announcement relating to military spending?
We all need to just continue to keep raising our voices and raising it at every opportunity that we can in whatever forum we can. I mean, militarism is a very dangerous and obviously violent ideology, and it's very hard to counteract because, you know, politicians, for their own purposes, will raise the spectre, oh, China's about to invade. Well, seriously, if China was about to invade, what is a navy with two frigates going to be able to do to stop it? New Zealand needs to be thinking about what it can usefully do for us all here in Aotearoa and also for our Pacific neighbours. And we would encourage everyone to think about what those alternatives are and to be promoting a peaceful path forward for our country.
That was Peace Movement Aotearoa Coordinator Edwina Hughes and Mass City University's Associate Professor in the Centre for Defence and Security Studies, Anna Powles, sharing their perspectives on increased military spending in light of the New Zealand government's recent budget announcement.
That was The Wire.
Era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Greenpeace's Dressa Lee, Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson, Associate Professor Anna Powles, and Peace Movement Aotearoa's Edwina Hughes. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.